My name's Perry Jago. What I want to talk about this afternoon briefly is facilitation, but in a different context to what a number of the presenters have talked about so far, which is the environment that I work in is large-scale, dynamic, simulation-supported. So what you'll see in the in this first slide is, in fact, the a game that we played about a couple of years ago, and they're all taken at the same game. And if you look at the top right, that represents a real-time meeting of the North Atlantic Council. On the bottom left, it represents an operational headquarter deployed in the field somewhere. So I have a still have a problem with this. So are we now seeing the second slide? Because I no longer could see teams at all.
That's fine.
Great, yeah. Okay. So what is facilitation and what is a facilitator? I won't read through all this, but it's simply helping other people to sort out their problem, their process, their discussion. And the facilitator is an individual who is process-driven and has no horse in the race. So he has to be neutral, individual, and is there simply to make the process work and to make it well and efficiently. So what kind of person makes a facilitator? All sorts of characteristics that I'll talk about a little bit more as we go along, but the key ones are the ones in the middle. It says a servant leader. A facilitator very often is up in front of the group and he's kind of guiding the group, but he's not a leader. He's only there to serve the group. So he's there as someone who can help the members of a group to do things they might not otherwise be able to achieve. And I think everybody has been in meetings, etc., that have descended into arguments because nobody's actually trying to help the process move forward. So in many ways, facilitation is quite like good chairmanship at times. And where do we fit in wargaming? These are kind of the different types of war games, creating knowledge, conveying knowledge and entertainment. The area that I work in is the creating knowledge. So unstructured and structured problems, discovery and analytical games. And we shorthand that as exploratory games. And that's where facilitation is necessary because you're on a voyage of exploration rather than trying to teach people and rather than just having fun. Although it should be fun if you're doing it right anyway. So the difference, exploratory war games are not exercises. And in many ways, training war games are akin to exercises. In an exercise, you're rehearsing for something you know about. You've trained for it. It's organized around events. There is a right answer, and you really ought to know it if you're going to do it well. And those who are collecting data are collecting it on how well you're doing. And data collection is not really very important. Exercises need someone making judgment calls. They need umpires. Exploratory war games are experiments. And in an experiment, you're trying to find out something new, doing things you've never done before. And it's not organized around events. It's organized around questions. Now, those questions will stimulate events, but events are only there to help answer the questions. You don't know what the answer is, and it's quite likely that nobody else does, not individually. Someone is collecting data on what you're doing, but most importantly, why you are doing it. Why did you make that decision? And data collection for analysis is priority number one. As we say in my program, if you didn't get the analysis, it didn't happen. And experiments need conditions to operate in, and that's where facilitation comes in. So why do we do it? Well, our job is to help keep the process on track. What we'll do is we will monitor progress throughout. Where necessary, we will chair meetings. I have had to be the General Secretary of the United Nations at times, various other things. So we will chair meetings, pose questions, steer discussions, but also try to collate and summarise the positions the players have reached so that we can see if we've reached consensus. And our bottom line aim is to ensure that the needs of analysis process, the players and the event schedule are balanced. And to do that, we work with the key stakeholders, which I'll talk a little bit about later on, to make sure that the game is making the necessary progress, but at the right kind of speed. And it can get difficult, because for everybody who's overloaded and working like a one-armed paper hanger, there is someone else who's bored to death because it's all going too slowly for them. So it's a difficult balancing act. But the most important note, and I'll keep emphasizing this, is this: we have no opinions of our own. Our role is to help the players form those. And as I describe it to the rest of the team and to our players, we are the oil in the machine. Okay, so I'll put this into context because the techniques that I'll talk about have been developed over quite a few years now, best part of 20, used in a wide range of games, but most significantly in a program that is set in a hypothetical epoch, 10 years in the future. So it is by nature exploratory and analytical. And it considers countering advanced air and missile threats. And as you'll have seen in Ukraine, there are a lot of advanced threats out there, and there are more on the way. It works at the strategic and operational levels with a strong policy focus. But to follow up from what Dr. Roberts said yesterday, we do represent the tactical situation realistically, but that is done through real-time simulation. So we don't have maps or anything at all. We actually have an operational picture which can go out to global level, which represents the tactical activities that are going on. We face the players with a range of adversaries on a global basis, and we cover all phases from global competition through emerging crisis up to full conflict. We should, in theory, go on to post-conflict, but we've never had time to get there yet. So playing the game, the program runs typically on a two-year cycle with 3 to 4 gaming events per cycle. Each game typically lasts about 5 days and will have up to 100 or often more participants. These players will come from a wide range of nations on a global basis, and also a number of international organisations, including, for example, the NATO international staff. The players are split between defence and foreign policy, plus legal advisers, and depending on the event, typically between NATO O4, so Lieutenant Colonel, and 2-star, or civilian equivalent. And if we can, we like to have a 50-50 balance between military and civilian, although generally speaking, it's easier to get the military people than the civilians. Our objectives are a mix between how to avoid getting into a fight, so dissuasion, deterrence, all the D's, and how to win one if we fail. Now, we won't try to do all those at the same time. That's why we'll have 3 or more gaming events per cycle. We will typically focus on one phase or the transition between phases. That said, the game has to be as realistic as possible, both for effective learning and also for player immersion. One of the key things is that the only real resource we have to learn from is the player's brains. So it's essential that those brains are working at optimum levels, which means they've got to be happy and enjoying themselves and be creative. So how do we learn to win a war if we're successful in avoiding one on day one? Well, to Nick from the Righteous Brothers, we actually put a chain on the melody. So at the start of each game, Red will have a set of strategic goals, and they will typically remain constant throughout the two-year cycle. Things like, you know, global domination, kick the West out of the rest of the planet, etc. Within those, Red has freedom of action, but he will have a range of pre-developed battle plans that are ready for use. So he's got options on the table, not least if you're going to conduct an air and missile campaign, you can't make it up on the fly. They do have the ability to actually ad hoc to some extent, but it's more a case of adapting plans they've already got. However, Red's hands are tied in some ways, because where the objectives need to be considered in an escalating situation, Red absolutely has to carry out antagonistic or hostile acts. So that is a directive that's on Red. You must do this, attack somewhere, make some hideous bit of rhetoric or whatever, something like that. But the problem is, while Red is getting all stroppy, we have a number of diplomats there who are constantly trying to defuse the situation. So they're always looking for the off ramps before we actually get into conflict. But if our military folks need to understand what happens when we do get into conflict, how do we square that circle? So what we do is we don't tie Red's hands behind his back, but we do constrain his options. and they fit into the battle plan in slightly different ways. So we have an example of the escalation curve here. What happens is that the first event, you'll see that, you know, it's intensity over time. It's just an example. The first event is typically scripted. Are you seeing the builds on this? I've got it. OK. Are you now seeing the builds?
We've got example escalation curve.
Have you then got where it says the first red event is generally pre-scripted?
Yes.
OK, that's great. So it is, and it's often used to bed the players in. Very often it'll be a pretty hardline exercise run by one of the adversaries. And very often we learn more from that than we were expecting. But red will always respond to blue's response. And red decides whether it sees blue's actions as escalatory, de-escalatory, or maintaining the status quo. And therefore will accelerate, increase, delay, or decrease its next move accordingly. So you'll see there are a number of options starting to open up. Three basic options every time. And so on. So every action has a reaction. In some cases, red may make alternative moves that are only used if things are escalated, etc. Or may create some ad hoc modifications. But the decisions on red's choices are made jointly by the red role players, by the analysis team, and by facilitation. So how does this take us in the direction that red would realistically go? How does this take us to answering the questions we've been set? And how will this affect gameplay? And then as it goes on, eventually we get to a thing that we refer to in shorthand as the red banana. This is a simplified version because every node has three options. We only show the main center line on this. But it gets even more complex because we can be running up to four bananas concurrently. If we have quite often three major state actors who are at various stages of antagonism and hostility, and we almost always have at least one non-state actor operating as well. So we've got a lot of moving parts, a heck of a lot of moving parts, and it can very, very easily go wrong if it's not properly monitored and controlled. So enter the facilitators. There is always a three-way balance needed between both sets of players, and by sets of players, I mean there may be three or four different red teams. There will be up to 20 different blue teams, and there will be the sponsors, and again, there'll be up to 20 of them. So if you don't facilitate this well and actually try to keep that balance, the way you'll get balance is that all of them will be equally, and I'll use the term disgruntled because I can't use the one that I would normally use during the game, which is the one that people often say to the facilitators. So what do we need? Typically, we need up to two facilitators for each region being gamed. These are global regions. There can be from one to four of these. We may be focusing on one, or we may be going on the whole thing, which would be Europe, North America, Middle East, and Asia Pacific. But there will also be global elements where we bring everybody together in global bodies, so we'll need a couple of folks to do that. So you can see we could need up to 10 for a major game. They are sourced from the participating nations, who look for volunteers, really. And because it is quite a challenging task, continuity is important, but we can't rely on it. So a great example, at our most recent event, one of the guys I rely on the most emailed a couple of days before and said, awfully sorry, I've tested positive. I'm stuck in a hotel room in Taiwan for the next 2 weeks. So we had to scurry around. I'm always looking for fresh blood, so I regularly trawl for volunteers, but we don't throw them straight to the lions. We run them through a formal training program, some of which is included in the following slides. So what sort of person are we looking for as a facilitator? Well, number one is the ability to listen. It's essential. Cultural awareness. We have people from all over the world. You have to understand that there is quite a significant difference, cultural difference, between an Australian and a Korean, or a Japanese, or a Saudi. So they must understand that. They really do need not to have an organization or a personal agenda. If they come from an organization that has got a horse in the race, then they must be allowed not to bring that organization's viewpoint into the mix. They have to be impartial. Now, a lot of facilitation literature says that in general, understanding the topic is not essential. I utterly disagree with that. It's complete nonsense, especially in a specialized war game. If you're wargaming, you have to understand the topic you're wargaming, not least so that you can actually see when players might be going down a rabbit hole. You have to understand the objectives. That's not challenging. They're all written down. It's just a case of reading through them and making sure you know where to find them for quick references. They do need very often to think on the fly, especially while listening. And that means that language skills, it's a lot easier for native English speakers or really, really good English speakers to be able to do this. But someone who has to translate in their head before they use another language would struggle in this. Now, we do need people like that, but they work with their national selves. People need good, simple language skills. Speak slowly, communicate clearly. And if you start talking in Cockney rhyming slang, I can assure you that even most of the rest of the UK team won't understand what you're talking about, let alone the rest of the planet. So we have to speak in clear, simple English as much as we can. And last but not least, teamwork. We said we will work as a team of 10, but we work with the other key stakeholders in the game. So prima donnas are not invited to join the team. Few things if you ever end up facilitating during play, and this is something I tell our facilitators, don't worry if you feel you're not saying or doing anything. The main thing is that the players should be saying and doing things, ideally the right things. And if everything is running perfectly, that's actually the facilitator's nirvana. And when I did my training through an NGO, actually, my final sort of session, the instructor worked out at the end. He said, you were trying to go for that, weren't you? But you failed. I said, yeah, I got about 5 minutes in and I had to step in. But actually, don't be worried. As long as you know what's going on and it is what's meant to be going on, don't do anything. So when you're in dynamic play, your main job is repair person. But you always have to be ready in case you need to step in to steer things, especially if the players want to do something a little bit different and they don't know who should take point in organising it, then that's the facilitator. But if they can organise themselves, so much the better. Number of tips that I pass on to my folks and that I'd recommend to anybody, you can find similar tips online. Understand the problem. Understand who the key players, the key topics are, and all of the issues that are around the objective. So when you read something that says, solve world hunger, understand what world hunger is, understand what some of the options might be, understand who's hungry and who's got the food, that sort of thing. So don't just read the objective and leave it at that. But don't develop your own conclusions, because we're only human. If you've made your own conclusions, you're going to lean towards them. You're going to do it anyway, but make sure that you're aware of the fact that you shouldn't, because if you come across as biased, then you lose the trust of the players. But nonetheless, you should have some idea. You should have almost sort of brainstormed the options that come out, so you have some idea of where you think the players might go. So you can actually, that will help you to stay ahead. They will often go somewhere unexpected, though, and you need to keep up. Top tip number two, at the start of anything, whether it's going into a game in the briefings, whether it's going into a meeting as part of gameplay, the key is to give a clear articulation of the issue and understand that everybody knows what the objective is. And again, if you're dealing in a multilingual environment, you've got to look around and see if people are awake, nodding, gone to sleep, etc. And keep doing this until you're sure that everyone understands where you're trying to go. So encourage inclusion. Take note of those who are and aren't speaking, particularly those who aren't, and look at the cultural differences. For example, Australians, Americans, Canadians, Brits will leap in, as will most Europeans. However, Asian nations will often wait to be invited to make their comments. So you've got to look at them. And it's very hard. I put at the bottom there Graham's phrase of reading the room, because very often you will look at participants who are not saying anything. And you've got to read the body language. Are they not speaking because they're waiting to be invited? Are they not speaking because they don't actually have anything they want to say? Or are they desperately hoping you are not going to invite them to speak because they would have to say something they don't particularly want to say? So it can be challenging. The best way to do that is perhaps to ask specific questions, but also always make them with an out. So if you would care to, Admiral, would you give us your view on this? We quite understand if we find you're not in a position to do so. So again, keep people talking. But where there is silence for a good reason, let it run. Silence procedures. There is nothing worse than doing a representation of the North Atlantic Council and hearing 20 people going, Mr. Chairman, Lower Moldorovia would like to speak. Please go ahead. Lower Moldorovia would like to say it agrees with all of the other nations who have already spoken. Well, thank you. So try to encourage silence procedures. But make sure that people get an opportunity to speak where it's relevant. Don't pick on people because that just makes things uncomfortable. That's a general rule. Sometimes it's quite good to pick on people because quite often you'll have a teacher's pet who you know will have something sensible to say. I tend to do that when I've run out of questions to ask and I'm trying to think what to do next. So stick to the issue is the next top tip. You've got to keep moving forward and addressing the objectives. Very often, certainly in our games, we find that the answer is building schools and solving world hunger. Great, that's really important. We need to note it, but then we need to move forward. So you need to keep it on course and working towards the objectives that the group is there to serve. Parking lots. Very often, other things will come up and you can capture that. So, for example, building schools can be really, really important. So write it down and just note we've got it written down. We'll come back to it if we need to. Sometimes, just sometimes, you do come up with something that is absolutely brilliant. I've seen it happen a number of times where we've been struggling with an issue and suddenly somebody comes up with a brilliant answer. You've got to capture that. You've got to make sure it's captured. You don't have to do it yourself. Typically, you get the analyst. You find the analyst in the room and say, make sure you write that down and then read it back to people. You know, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is to make sure that everyone agrees and has a chance to join in. Said this before, stay objective. Do not join someone's camp. If you lean towards someone and say, yes, Smithy over there is absolutely right, as always, you're going to start upsetting people. And that, you know, once you lose trust, it's very difficult to keep it going. I've said it before, it is, and I'll say it again, it is ask, don't tell. It's the problem and the solution both belong to the players, not the facilitators. If the facilitator starts answering the question, there is no point in the players being there. And he could very easily be utterly wrong. I've seen it happen more than once. Don't get hijacked. Yesterday, I think it was Dr. Roberts mentioned how challenging it can be to deal with senior politicians who have their own views, which are sometimes right and sometimes other than that. But if you're facilitating and you've got senior people in the room, it's your job to keep them in check. It can be extremely difficult, and I would certainly never recommend putting a new facilitator in a situation like that. It's very, very challenging. And be in control. Keep it moving forward. If someone is monopolizing it, you have to get it back off of them. If someone, it's almost like teacher's pet, is always trying to come in to answer the next question, you have to actually politely ask them if they would hold back. Or sometimes you have to politely and blindly turn Nelson's blind eye to them, and it can upset them. It has upset them. But if someone else is taking over the thing, it just upsets everybody else in the room. So despite all those tips, the main thing about facilitation is it's like jazz. You've got to be prepared to make it up as you go along, using all the tools that are in your toolkit, but not going for a rigid approach. And why? Well, the bottom line is that it's the facilitator's one and only job is to give the participants ownership of the process. But in terms of the analysis and the objectives, making sure they're working on the right questions, and in terms of effectiveness, keeping them in the right frame of mind to be creative. It's not always easy, but it has been described that facilitation is like herding cats. The last event that I had to facilitate was what we call a senior leader event, which went up to 4-star level. And what can I say? That is not particularly like herding cats. It's more like herding saber-toothed tigers. And that's all I have. I think I've got us pretty much back on time. Do you have any questions?